Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer. Hello and welcome to another episode of Table Talk, The Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast.
And I'm Olivia Potts.
And we're delighted to be joined by the restaurateur Jeremy King. The co-founder of Corbin & King, together with his business partner Chris Corbin, Jeremy has co-owned and created some of London's most iconic and cherished restaurants. Le Caprice, The Ivy, Jay Shiki, The Wolseley, The Delaunay, Zadel, Colbert, Fisher's, Bellanger, the list goes on. And their latest restaurant, Soutine, opened recently in St John's Wood. Jeremy, thank you very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure, a very pleasure.
Jeremy, we're going to start where we always start, at the very beginning. You grew up in Somerset.
Yes.
Can you tell us what food was like for you as a child at home?
You know, the truth of the matter is I can't remember that much of in the food experience. You say I grew up in Somerset. In fact, I was born in Somerset and we ended up back in Somerset, but we were quite peripatetic in the interim. And I was thinking, when you said food memories, unfortunately, the first one for me would be the day as a three-year-old we moved to Hertfordshire and we stopped by the roadside to have sandwiches, and the family friend who was driving us had a ham sandwich. And of course, you've got to remember, this was in the 50s, and the ham had that thick white fat on it, and he lost a tooth eating it, and I watched him extract his tooth from the white fat and ham, and that precluded me from eating ham until I was about 35. So
it's a very sage approach in circumstances, actually.
But really, my food memories were very, very, very scant.
And what about when you went to school? You're educated at Christ Hospital. What was the food like there?
It was never renowned. It was we had a dining hall. If you can imagine, we sat down with 800 boys under one roof to eat whatever it was, breakfast, lunch. It's interesting, you're challenging my memory. We used to drink kiff, which is very difficult to tell whether it was meant to be coffee or chocolate. It seemed to be ambiguous in that way, out of big bowls. And that was perhaps my fondest memory. All the food which was left from school was scraped off plates, and it was called skiffage. That was the typical public school terminology. And every Friday, we would be served up skiffage pie. This is against a background that our scrambled eggs would be made with powdered eggs. And there was no real excuse, because by then it was mid-60s. So my school food memories, in fact, I think what turned me round was when I became a senior boy. I used to go into the local town, but even then I sound a bit Nigel Slater. We used to buy things like Angel Delight, or I think there were Vesta curries and Vesta chow meins and things like that, and cook ourselves. In fact, I remember being caught smoking, and in my defence, I launched a rather large defence where I showed from the encyclopedia that hunger had various ways of assuaging, and one was to eat, another one was to smoke, because it would close those things. So I posited to the school that because the food was so bad that I was compelled to smoke, and they actually got away with it on that occasion. But it was terrible. What really helped me, though, was a new headmaster who won. The food was slightly better on the senior boys' table, and he one evening said, "We're going to go back to my study and warm a bottle of claret in front of the fire." And I was intrigued by that, and I was starting to read much more, so I liked the notion of that. And I think it started to culminate that from a holiday job working in a cafe and selling ice cream, etc., I suddenly got interested. And so by the time I finished A-levels, I, instead of going up to town for my 24-hour exeat, I remember going to Petworth to look at the Petworth House, and where Turner, my hero, had painted, and I ate a meal by myself at the Petworth Hotel, roll mop herrings at the time, and every taste, every mouthful seemed so special. And there was a chicken main course, and suddenly I think that launched my love of not only food, but also eating by myself.
You then received a place at Cambridge, but you decided against it, and fate pulled you into the hospitality industry. Can you tell us a bit about what happened?
Well, yes, first of all, I was actually going to go to Lancaster University, and then I decided I'd go into the city because I'm quite arithmetic and I was going to make a fortune in the city, and I hated it. And in the interim, I supplemented income by working in a wine bar, which was a new phenomenon in London, particularly in Chelsea, where it was, to supplement income. And when I realised I hated the city and left to go to Cambridge, having then got my second chance, much to my parents' relief, something about it was very special. And it's not, it's partly the food, it's partly the interaction. Even though I was a very, very shy person, I think the moment my memories come back, you know, strange ways, but I remember being offered a £20 note at the beginning of a service, and £20 was a lot in 1974. And there's two young models from the models agency, and when they saw me balk at taking this £20 note, which was my entire float, they said, "Oh, terribly sorry, we'd never carry anything less." And I thought, okay. And as I trudged away to the till, I suddenly thought, So I turned and said, "That's okay then. If that's the case, you won't want the change." And then suddenly thought, "Oh, I quite like this. I like that it's not about conformity as the city was." And the food was okay, but it taught me more my love of wine, and I started to collect wines at that point, a lot of which got completely out of condition because they were like my children, all the wines. Any wine which was featured in Hugh Johnson's Wine Atlas was coveted by me, so that gave birth to that.
And the actual decision-making process itself was an unusual one, it would be fair to say.
I know what you're alluding to, yeah. And I sometimes talk to my new staff about it, is that I was foolish enough to read a book called The Dice Man, which came out in 73, I think it was, which was a cult novel about a man who determined every step of his life by the throw of a die. And I started to do it recreationally, and where to go for dinner or whatever it might be. Then I started to do it to determine what character I was when I went into the city, because I was bored. You know, I could be any number of strange things, and nobody would really notice. Even if I was Long John Silver, they didn't really quite understand. And then when matriculation papers came through for Cambridge, I foolishly threw the dice, a complicated throw, and the 1 out of 12 throws was if I got managership of the wine bar or similar within a month of my 21st birthday, then I'd stay in the business for life. And that came up, and to my parents' horror, and there I was. And something which in some ways I'm grateful for, and in other ways I deeply regret.
And what was food in London like back in the 1970s? I mean,
it was fascinating, really. It's got nothing to do with how it is now. I mean, we talk about, everybody is revisionist on how London's food has changed. I read an interview with a restaurateur recently who was saying 20 years ago, there was no good food to be had in London. That's nonsense, absolute nonsense. But if you go back 40 years or 45 years into the 70s, then it was hard, but not impossible. There were places, all sorts of interesting restaurants. And I think people underestimate how Marion Franco, with all the Italians, was so instrumental in changing the way, not only the way people ate, but I think the interesting thing is that eating in London was very much a class thing. And you had restaurants which knew their places. There were upper-class restaurants, middle-class restaurants, poorer restaurants. And I remember when we eventually opened Caprice in 1981, I was trying to, because I'm autodidact, I'm not a trained restaurateur, I would then observe things and say, why can't we take orders whereby we don't have to ask people who's having what, and just it just happens. Oh no, you wouldn't do that in a restaurant like this, because it was a class thing. That's for smart restaurants, not for brasserie type restaurants. And it's worth remembering. I mean, you know, I had so little food experience as a child. Occasionally, we'd go to the local hotel, and this was, in fact, my mother used to help them there as on a secretarial basis, and she would take us. And you have to remember that at the time, if you were eating out, as I did with my family, occasionally in a hotel, the menu was almost always the same. It would be a fruit juice, a soup, maybe a melon, perhaps with some parma ham when they got really, really extravagant, but often just the melon. So it went on. So it was nothing to be excited about. In fact, it was rather daunting. When they did some research in 1981, when we opened Caprice, and the research was, how often does the average Brit eat in a proper restaurant, i.e. a white tablecloth restaurant, a year? And you might think, oh, must be 3, 4, 5 times a year or something. In those days, it was well below one. And you had to, there were still people eating out 250, 300 times a year or more. So there was no going eating out concept. But people were breaking the barriers. And I have fond memories of the Italian resurgence, but also places like the Hungry Horse and a whole raft of places. And indeed, even Terence Conran started to make a difference as time went on.
And Caprice then became the London restaurant of the 1980s. What do you think made it quite so popular?
I think we changed a lot of the rules. And I think the combination that Chris was a properly trained restaurateur and I, as I say, autodidact. So he would sort of say, well, this is how you would normally do it. And then I would deconstruct. So Caprice as a decor was very unusual. Not to people from Manhattan. We had pro rata greater support from Manhattan than we did from London because they got it. And this is a time when restaurants like Odeon were opening down in Tribeca, which was, the molds were being broken. And we combined dishes on a menu and said, let's give people what they want to eat. So some things which are very common now whereby, for instance, having dishes like an Eggs Benedict, and you can have small as a starter or large as a main course. That never happened. Or salads with two sides, steak tartare, anything. Seems normal now. And it was so starched, the restaurant scene. The big dilemma, particularly as we had a lot of Americans, was that come dessert time, the tradition was that the British would order dessert and coffee and would finish the dessert and then the coffee would be served. But Americans, if they ordered dessert and coffee, the coffee would be expected to arrive before the dessert even. So how did you reconcile this? So we'll do it a bit quicker with the British and a bit, and so on. And the British were saying, you're rushing us, and the Americans were saying, where the hell's the coffee? So as I said to them, why don't we just ask? Why don't we just say, would you like the coffee with or after the dessert? That was radical. But a lot of things like that. And I think, but what makes the real difference in restaurants is proprietorship. And we were prepared to be there. So right through the 80s and certainly until we opened the Ivy and beyond, you would find either Chris or myself in the restaurant. And that I often say about restaurateuring, the easy way to do it is the hard way, and that means being there.
Many of the restaurants that you either have in the group at the moment or have previously had the proprietorship over are incredible buildings in their own rights, but had faded in their glory, perhaps, when you came to them. How do you go about choosing the right building for one of your restaurants?
It's an interesting question. And it's true, under Caprice Holdings, until we sold that and left in 2000, those had been existing restaurants which we'd refurbished, and we rather liked that tradition, even though Caprice looked nothing like the Caprice of the late 40s when that opened. When having sold that, we were looking originally to go into hotels, and I was offered the Wolseley site, which was actually called China House then, on Piccadilly. And I said, "Oh, I don't want to do a restaurant in a bank building. They don't work. The atmosphere is really strange, and so on." And I said, "Well, I'll go and have a look." And then I took Chris down. I said, "What do you think?" And he said, "Well, you know, you've always dreamt of a Grand Cafe. Isn't this the place?" And I said, "Yes, I have to admit that this is exactly the place." And we both knew immediately how it would be, that little bit of Viennese coffee house influence matching a French brasserie. And always from there on, the way which you decide to do a restaurant has been very much dictated by the building. Restaurateurs make the mistake of trying to impose on a building in an inappropriate concept. So often, I mean, it's something I particularly enjoy. So I'll say, I remember when we were buying the site, which became Fisher's, and I was being asked, "So what's it going to be?" I said, "I don't know." And they said, "Well, surely you must know." I said, "No, I haven't spent enough time there." And then it suddenly came to me is that, yes, this is a place that somebody, refugees from Vienna in the early 30s, would have set up here, because you either went to northwest London or to into East London, and they would create something like you would find in Vienna, and so it went on. But it's always the building. Even Chic is. I remember phoning up the agent who was looking for us, and I said, "Here's the brief: 8,000 square foot on one floor, one room, and so easy service from the kitchen." And he presented a couple of restaurants. I said, "No, it doesn't feel right." When one day I phoned him up and I said, "We found the restaurant." And he said, "Oh, great." And I said, "Even though we found it, you can represent us." He said, "What is it?" And I said, "Chic is." And he said, I mean, he swore at me, actually, but he told me I was an idiot. He said, "You want 8,000 square foot on one floor, one room. Chic is 3,500 square foot over two floors with five rooms. How do you justify that?" And I said, "Just like the feel." And so it went on. And even Colbert, that when Cadogan Estate asked us to do that, when we won the competition, everybody wanted that site, it was to do a Wolseley light, effectively. But having spent time in the building and in the area, I asked them, I said, "You know, I think it's wrong. I think it's imperious for the West End to be coming to Chelsea. Let's create something just for Chelsea." So to Cadogan's credit, they said, "Okay, go ahead." And that's why that restaurant appeared. And if you look at Colbert, you'll see that there's three different rooms, and they're all so-called built in a different area. We got it as a concrete shell, but imagine that it started with the bar and the proprietor, and then expanded into the next room, and the decor and the difference between the bar and the corner room, and then through to another room, and again a different that was all about French movies. The corner room is all about the Paris during the war, because that was the period I imagined it been done. So there's a massive history about that restaurant, which is a faux history, but you hang your sentiment and your hat on it, and it gives it what I think is the most important ingredients in any restaurant, and most people forget, which is heart and soul.
I mean, your restaurants often feel like places straight out of the pages of a novel. I mean, is that deliberate?
In many ways, I like the story. We don't tell the story necessarily. You can find it out if one wants, because I may have talked about it. And I've been thrilled that more and more often, for instance, Fisher's was put into a spy novel recently, which was set in a different period. And I love that. And you see, one of my frustrations and why I'm in the restaurant business is because I suppose in some ways I was a architect manqué, or I'd love to be able to perform, to write, to create in different ways, but I never thought I'd be quite good enough to be really special in any of those disciplines. But through restaurants, there is the ability to actually to find outlets. And so I love the histories more than anything, particularly when people believe them.
And do you enjoy watching the characters in your restaurants and the characters working for your restaurants?
Very much so. I am a watcher. And it goes back to what I was saying earlier about I enjoy eating by myself in a restaurant. It is something very special. particularly special on Valentine's night, which I've done a few times when I found myself abroad or something, or in the country in the UK, and it's interesting watching people.
Is there a central thread for you personally, as the restaurateur? Is there a central thread that runs through all the different restaurants that you've opened during the years?
One would imagine, but actually no. I mean, often we get asked, are we perhaps too French-centric? So I think if there was a thread, it was probably Escoffier and Larousse and so on, rather than anything else, because that was classical cooking. And I often get asked, wouldn't you do something, Italian or whatever? Well, we've tried a couple of times. It's really if the building suggests it. I think it's, if there is a thread, it would be summarized possibly by saying that we would feel that our particular type of restaurateuring, which tends to be grand cafes, is at the heart of culture. And if you think about it, all political, artistic, literary movements have often been given birth in grand cafes and on the boulevards of Paris or Budapest or Moscow or wherever it might be. So I think it's that love of the culture. And any restaurateur worth their salt must understand it's not all about them. It's about being a catalyst for change and providing an environment which makes people feel comfortable, which allows them to thrive, and not to be dominated by a particular tribe. And often one of the things we always say about the restaurants is that if a lot of the most interesting people who come to restaurants are actually the least affluent, being rich is not a qualification. So we work on the basis that we'll give people the opportunity to spend, but we don't make it mandatory. So it allows people of lesser means, and sometimes that's, temporary or maybe on the scale upwards, it just gives them the opportunity to participate, which I find particularly good. And that's even more exemplified perhaps by Zadel, where we worked on the basis we'll make it really accessible and a treat for a student, because going out is always a treat anyway, and as more of a canteen for the affluent. And then we get such a wide range. We get very young, we get quite old, because what called the Grey Pound seize upon it, because they can have dinner for six for the price of dinner for two, and people can be generous. And I think there's a lot of, everything is so starched at the moment that neither generosity has been killed, and particularly generosity from restaurateurs. It's all about looking at people coming through the door as a source of income. How can I upsell and all those sort of things? Rather than what we do is we look at people coming through the portal on the basis that it's an opportunity to give somebody a good time. And if we give them a good time, then we'll make money. But restaurateuring and money making are not always consistent.
What about Soutine? Is there a story behind your latest restaurant?
A sort of story, but not a. There's not. Fishers and Colbert have proprietorial stories. The Soutine is more about thinking about the area and what St. John's Wood is, and for me it was always a big artist community. And if you walk around the streets of St. John's Wood, you'll see a lot of blue plaques and the people like Tissot were there, or they handed over to Alma Tadema, etc. And what I found is that in research is that there used to be a St. John's Wood art school, which I didn't know about, and nobody really knew, which was unique in that it encouraged women to become artists, which was not accepted in the 19th century, and then were sending people to the Royal Academy. They closed, and it was taken over by a guy called Calderon, who opened the Anglo-French Art Centre, and he'd come back from Paris, and he'd witnessed what they called the School of Paris, which was basically 1910 to the early 30s. And so I just kept following my nose. I thought, I like this. There's this sense of an artistic community. And there was what was called the St. John's Wood Art Clique. And then it was interesting because most of the School of Paris were actually displaced Jewish immigrants who landed in Paris. And you had people like Chagall Modigliani and Chaim Soutine. And so I started to think more about Soutine, of course, who his love was painting chefs and waiters and bellboys and carcasses and food and so on. And so that then the name came around. So it's very much based on that, as if it was a place that the artistic community might have embraced.
You spend quite a lot of time in your restaurants. I've read that you breakfast in your restaurant 7 days a week. What do you do when you're outside the restaurant? So I imagine that it's not an unstressful role that you have. What do you do to de-stress outside?
Yeah, I think in my... it's a strange thing to say, but and it's not very necessarily fair on those close to me, but in, I think in Who's Who I list one of my interest or hobby is solitude. And it's important that I have that time, and often... And solitude might include our dog, but I like cycling for solitude. I think one of the important things in life which we miss out on, and I try and tell all the people in the restaurant business, is that yes, we get tired and there's the stress and so on, is that if we're going to be with our family, we then must be with them and not slumped in a chair and comatose or anything, because there's nothing worse than being married into the restaurant business where the hours are very long and there's a lack of understanding. And so I take a certain amount of time to myself, and then I try and forget. I'm particularly lucky that I have an ability to switch off and then switch on very quickly and then switch off again. So I'm always available if needed. But I'm not the person who's necessarily going to phone up and say, how are things, how are you doing? Because there's nothing more irritating for a member of staff than a boss asking that question. Just leave me alone. I just, let me get on with it.
And do you like to cook yourself?
I do like cooking, particularly when I have time. So more often it would be on holiday. Although there was a point before my children got to an age, and I think we might be going back to it, that I particularly enjoy cooking for a Sunday evening. And the enjoyment was actually more often than not in concocting, for want of a better word, stews. They might come in different forms. It might be a daube or a boeuf bourguignon or a chicken dish. But there's something about it and building combinations of flavours and layers of flavour. And also because it's relaxed. And I think cooking should be relaxed, and it's rather like a dinner party. You would.
That was one of the questions. Do you like hosting?
I felt we were going. it's interesting with the dinner party. I think the best dinner parties is when you get people away from eating with their elbows glued to their sides, which is the British way. It's impediment to conviviality. So if you put food which has to be passed or shared or so on, some of the most riotous evenings we've had is because we had a raclette evening. So there'll be 12 or 14 people. And it's somewhat helped by the fact that if you're eating raclette and so on, you're not meant to drink water because it has. So, of course, people drink too much wine. It's convivial, but passing it all around the table, effectively the elbows go out rather than in, and that leads to a better situation. I think one of the other problems of I always think with dining and dinner parties is that people always obsess who's going to sit next to each other. But actually, unless you have a very grand table, it's the person you're sitting opposite or a slight angles who's really, really important. Because in a normal domestic dining table, you often don't talk so much to the people next to you. It's only if you're on a 4 foot wide table in a grand house.
And what about puddings? Do you have a sweet tooth?
I do. My sweet tooth is almost an addiction for chocolate. But and interestingly, whilst I can go to a garage and get petrol and not buy chocolate, there is something about that, and people disparagingly call it white trash chocolate, which is very addictive. I can eat as much as you put in front of me, but that's why I never buy it, because that's the problem. I do have quite a sweet tooth, but I'm stopped myself at the moment. Choice between sweet and savoury, I'd go with the savoury.
And finally, I suppose we have to ask, do you still make decisions using a roll of the dice?
Not actually, although I have two dice on my desk at home to remind me. about that. And the reminder is that not only should the decisions not be irrational or uncontrollable, but the decisions should also be from the heart and from the gut. Because everything I regret in my life has been something I've done because I felt I should, rather than what I wanted. You never regret the wants. And what I try and teach my children, my staff, everybody, just as long as you follow your heart and instinct, then you have a chance for happiness.
Jeremy, what a lovely note to end on. And thank you so much for joining us. It's been a complete pleasure.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us on the Spectator's Food and Drink podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories and drinks, you can head to the Spectator website. La pauvre fleur disait au papillon ciel.